46. Killer asked the chief how he's making out. Von Kleiner was fretting beneath the calm set of his features. Night was closing, and in the darkness, even the frail little English destroyer was a danger to him. There was danger all around. Danger must each minute be approaching from every quarter of the sea. He must have power on his port side engine before nightfall. It was a matter of survival. He must have speed to carry him south through the hunting packs of the British, south to where Esther waited to give him succour, to replace the shell he had fired away, to replenish his coal bunkers, which were now dangerously depleted. Then, once more, Blücher would be a force to reckon with. But first, he must have speed. Kapitän, Killer was beside him. Commander Lochtkamper reports, they have cleared the oil lines of the main bearing. They have stripped the bearing, and there is no damage to the shaft. He is fitting new half-shells. The work is well advanced, sir. The words conjured up for von Kleiner a picture of half-naked men, smeared to the elbows with black grease, sweating in the confined heat of the drive-shaft tunnel as they worked. How much longer? He asked. He promised full power on both engines within 2 hours, sir. Von Kleiner sighed with relief, and glanced over his stern at the British destroyer that was shadowing him. He began to smile. I hope, my friend, that you are a brave man. I hope, when you see me increase speed, you will not be able to control your disappointment. I hope tonight you will try with your torpedoes so that I can crush you, for your eyes always on me are a dangerous embarrassment. He spoke so softly that his lips barely moved. Then he turned back to Killer. I want all the battle lights checked and reported.
Aye, aye, sir.
Von Kleiner crossed to the voice tubes. Gunnery officer, he said. I want X turret guns loaded with star shells and trained to maximum elevation. He went on, listing his preparations for night action, and then he ended. Stand all your gun crews down. Let them eat and rest. From dusk action stations onwards, they will be held in the first degree of readiness.
Commander, sir. The urgent call startled Commander Charles Little, and he spilled his mug of cocoa. This was the first period of rest he had allowed himself all day, and now it was interrupted within 10 minutes.
What is it?
He flung open the door of the chart room and ran out onto the bridge.
Blücher is increasing speed rapidly.
No. It was too cruel a blow, and the exclamation of protest was wrung from Charles. He darted to the voice pipe.
Gunnery officer, report your target.
A moment's delay. Then the reply,
bearing mark green 00, range 05050, speed 17 knots.
It was true. Blücher was under full power again, and with all her guns still operable. Orion had died in vain. Charles wiped his mouth with the open palm of his hand and felt the brittle stubble of his new beard rasp under his fingers. Beneath the tan, his face was sickly pale with strain and fatigue. There were smears of dark blue beneath his eyes, and in the corners were tiny lumps of yellow mucus. His eyes were bloodshot, and the wisp of hair that escaped from under the brim of his cap was matted onto his forehead by the salt spray as he peered into the gathering dusk. The fighting madness, which had threatened all that day to overwhelm him, rose slowly from the depth of his belly and his loins. He no longer struggled to suppress it.
"Turn 2 points to starboard, pilot. All engines full ahead together."
The engine telegraph clanged, and Bloodhound pivoted like a polo pony. It would take her 30 minutes to work up to full speed, and by that time it would be dark.
Sound action stations.
Charles wanted to attack in the hour of darkness before the moon came up. Through the ship the alarm bells trilled, and without taking his eyes from the dark,
dot on the darkening horizon, Charles listened to the reports coming into the bridge, until the one for which he waited. "Torpedo party closed up, sir." Now he turned and went to the voice tube. "Torps," he said, "I hope to give you a chance at Blucher with both port and starboard tubes. I'm going to take you in as close as possible." The men grouped around Charles on the bridge listened to him say, "as close as possible," and knew that he had pronounced sentence of death upon them. Henry Sargent, the navigating lieutenant, was afraid. Stealthily he groped in the pocket of his overcoat until he found the little silver crucifix that Lynette had given him. It was warm from his own body heat. He held it tightly. He remembered it hanging between her breasts on its silver chain, and the way she had lifted both hands to the back of her neck as she unclasped it. The chain had caught in the shiny cascade of hair as she had tried to free it, kneeling on the bed, facing him. He had leaned forward to help her, and she had clung to him, pressing the warm, smooth bulge of her pregnant stomach against him. "God protect you, my darling husband," she had whispered. "Please God bring you back safely to us." And now he was afraid for her and the daughter he had never seen. "Hold your course, damn you," he snapped at Herbert Cryer, the helmsman.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Herbert Cryer replied with just a trace of injured innocence in his tone. No man could hold Bloodhound true when she hurled herself from swell to swell with such abandoned violence. She must yaw and throw her head that fraction before the helm could correct her. The reprimand was unjustified, uttered in fear and tension.
"Give it a flipping break, mate," Herbert retorted silently. "You're not the only one who's going to catch it. Tighten up the old arsehole like a bloody officer and a ruddy gentleman."
In these wordless exchanges of repartee with his officers, Herbert Cryer was never bested. They were wonderful release for resentments and pent-up emotion. And now, because he was also afraid, he became silently lyrical.
"Climb aboard Romeo's, one-way express to flipping glory."
Commander Little's reputation with the ladies had resulted in him being irreverently but affectionately baptized by his crew. "Come along with us. We're off to shout at the devil while Charlie kisses his daughter." Herbert glanced sideways at his commander and grinned. Fear made the grin wolfish, and Charles Little saw it and misinterpreted it. He read it as a mark of the same berserk fury that possessed him. The two of them grinned at each other for an instant in complete misunderstanding before Herbert refocused his attention on Bloodhound's next wild crabbing lunge. Charles was afraid as well. He was afraid of finding a weakness in himself, but this was the fear that had walked at his right hand all his life, close beside him, whispering to him, "Harder, try harder. You must do it better, you must do it quicker or bigger than they do, or they'll laugh at you. You mustn't fail, not in one thing, not for one moment. You mustn't fail, you mustn't fail." This fear was the eternal companion and partner in every venture on which he embarked. It had stood beside the 13-year-old Charles in a duck blind when he fired a 12-gauge shotgun and wept slow, fat tears of agony every time the recoil smashed into his bruised bicep and shoulder. It had stooped over him as he lay in the mud, hugging a broken collarbone. "Get up," it hissed at him, "get up." It had forced him to his feet and led him back to the unbroken colt to mount again and again and again. So conditioned was he to respond to its voice that when it crouched beside him now, twisted and misshapen on the footplate of the bridge, its presence almost tangible, and croaked so Charles alone could hear it, "Prove it! Prove it!" There was only one course open to Charles Little. A peregrine stooping at a golden eagle, he took his ship in against the Blucher.